From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Last week, I had a conversation with Nicole Rucker that left me shook. We were talking pie, of course, specifically apple. And as we chatted about the merits of thicker cut apples and the flavor of Pink Ladies versus Granny Smith, Nicole said something that I just can't get out of my head.
You know, there's also a case to be made for frozen apple slices that are thawed and seasoned well. And that is the taste of a classic apple pie that most people think of.
That is shocking to me that you would say that. Shocking.
It's April, Evan. I'm not going to the farmer's market and getting a bunch of beautiful, freshly picked apples, but I think that in a pinch, we love other frozen things. We love frozen blueberries.
This is why I love Nicole Rucker. For those of you who aren't familiar, Nicole was the first baker to have multiple wins at Good Foods Pie Contest. She went on to win a first place ribbon at the American Pie Council National Championship. But more to the point, here locally, she has two pie shops, Fat and Flour in Grand Central Market and in Culver City. She also wrote a fantastic cookbook about a fruit called dappled. And with only 1 week left until this year's Pie Fest and Contest, she is here to drop a lot of knowledge on apple pie. I started out by asking her how she makes her crumble topping.
Yes, great question. Crumble is a lot of people's favorites in terms of fruit pie topping. I make two different types of crumbles right now. One is a cream cheese-based crumble, and the other is an oat and brown sugar-based crumble.
Now, when you say cream cheese, is the cream cheese worked into the crumble ingredients, or is it just paired with the crumble in the way you put the pie together?
It is a component of the crumble in the way that you would incorporate butter. So we remove some of the butter from the crumble recipe, and we replace it with cream cheese, and then we, you know, mix it up into like a streusel type crumble topping, and that gets put on the pies and baked as you would a normal crumble, except it just has this like kind of tender and slightly tangy cream cheese dough flavor and texture to it that I was craving one day and just decided to give it a try.
And besides the cream cheese crumble that you just described, what is another crumble that you're using currently?
We've used a brown sugar-based oat crumble for years and years. That's kind of what I think of as the classic crumble. Definitely has some like whole intact oats in it, flour, brown sugar, a hefty amount of salt, and a lot of butter. And it typically stays pretty like sandy and streusely on the top of the pie.
Okay, so let's talk about a lattice top, because this year one of our categories of apple pie is double crust, which also includes lattice. I almost never make them because I don't love the way the underbaked parts that are underneath the interlaced strips of dough happen. How do you deal with lattice and when do you use it?
I think that they're gorgeous. I agree with you that they do have some areas where they can go wrong. Underbake, too thick, especially at the edges where it meets the crust and underneath the little woven parts. You're right, it does typically show up as underbake. I also think that people generally don't use enough of a weave on top, and so they have this huge open gaps in between the strips, and that is going to let too much moisture evaporate from the pie filling, and it ends up shrinking and looking kind of like sad. But a beautifully made, like thick strip, very tight woven lattice, I think can be really gorgeous. I think the way to accomplish that is to roll the top crust thinner than you would roll the bottom crust, so that when you have those woven sections and it's woven really tight, you're not having to worry about the dough being the same thickness as the rest of the pie so that it bakes faster and more evenly.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, so let's go back to those frozen apple slices. How do you manage the moisture that must come out of those frozen apples?
Okay, so one thing I think that is magical about frozen apple slices is that when you thaw them, the cell wall is broken, and so the liquid automatically comes out. So I would leave them to thaw in the fridge overnight, and then in the morning, you'll have this bowl of apples that has a bunch of liquid all around it, and you can drain it off. It's apple juice, so you could technically season it and cook it down into a syrup if you wanted to play with something like that, because it is apple juice. And then I would season them really well, and I would probably pre-cook half of them so that they have like some extra layer of flavor, and then mix in some uncooked thawed apples in addition. And I think you'll be shocked what happens at the end. I mean, you'll have this flavor that is so apple-y, and it's like this iconic apple flavor that you can create. And it's, you know, I just don't see why we wouldn't want that, especially if we're in the middle of summer and you want an apple pie.
My birthday is in July, and every year I would ask for an apple pie.
I would rather have an apple pie in July made with frozen green apples than an apple pie in July made with apples that have been sitting in a chemically induced coma for a year at the grocery store in their like special apple walk-in or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Do you like adding spices or any other additions to the filling, or are you kind of a purist?
I've done so many variations on apples over the years. I wouldn't say I'm a purist. I went through a phase where I didn't love apples and cinnamon, and now I'm back on it, and I think that apples and cinnamon with butter and salt is like a godlike flavor profile. I did recently work on a recipe for my next cookbook that has dried toasted fig leaves with the apples. And, you know, fig leaves are starting to pop up on people's trees right now. And that adds kind of like a green tea, almost like a coconutty flavor to the apple that's really unique and special. I have made in past years a sesame apple pie. Sesame and apple pairs excellent together. Sesame seeds, you know, you could add a little sesame oil for like a toasted note and just try not to get it too savory. But especially with green apple, the butteriness of sesame is really wonderful. Our friend Cheryl Day makes a wonderful apple pie recipe that has rose water in addition to cinnamon and salt and I believe brown sugar. And it's an excellent, just a really beautiful pairing of the floral note with the fruity and the cinnamon. It's gorgeous.
Well, thank you so much, Nicole. It's been such a fun conversation.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited to see what these bakers make.
Nicole Rucker is a prize-winning pie maker and chef owner of two Fat and Flour locations, the original in Grand Central Market and a relatively new space in Culver City. We look forward to welcoming her to the demo stage and as a judge at this year's Pie Fest and Contest on Sunday, April 28th at UCLA. If you dream of opening a pie shop one day like Nicole, then I hope you've already entered this year's pie contest. If you haven't, you can still do so at kcrw.com/pies. And for all of you eaters, as always, you are invited to taste the competition pies, but this year is a little different. In order to make sure there is enough pie to go around, you'll need to purchase a tasting ticket. Each ticket includes a year of KCRW membership, an exclusive tote bag, and two glorious slices of the competition pie. RSVP at kcrw.com/pie to get a link to buy tickets. And if you're not trying the competition pies, our pie marketplace has you covered. We will have vendors on site selling, you guessed it, pie. It all goes down next Sunday, April 28th at UCLA's Royce Quad. I'll see you there. Coming up, brisket tamales and matzo ball soup with chilies, lime, and cilantro. Discover how the Jewish diaspora celebrates Passover around the world. Next. Welcome back to Good Food. When you think about Jewish food, Do you imagine a steaming bowl of matzo ball soup, a hunk of brisket, maybe some gefilte fish, and copious amounts of matzah? These are all delicious dishes, but they only represent food eaten by Ashkenazi Jews, whose origins lie in Central and Eastern Europe. From Baghdad and Buenos Aires to Montreal and Mexico City, the Jewish diaspora encompasses an array of cultures with food and traditions that span many global cuisines. Nama Shefi showcases them in her new cookbook, The Jewish Holiday Table. Since launching the Jewish Food Society in 2017, she's dedicated herself to documenting and preserving Jewish food in all its global diasporic glory. Hi, Nama.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. The book is really fantastic. I just love the combination of stories from so many people with so many different backgrounds and the photographs, which just serve the food and the people so well. What are the most common misconceptions that you come across when you talk to people about Jewish food?
I mean, there are so many. When I arrived to New York City in 2006, I was just really amazed by how people thought about our food. So oftentimes when you speak with people around you, when they think about Jewish food, they think about a very narrow definition of Jewish food. So most people will think about gefilte fish and matzo ball and chopped liver and deli food. So mostly Ashkenazi food. And even within the Ashkenazi food, mostly a very narrow idea of Ashkenazi Jewish food. But when I think about Jewish food, I think about Yemenite kubane or jachnon or Iraqi sabich or dafina or just so many dishes, because wherever Jewish people lived across, the diaspora, they developed their own micro cuisine.
The book is about global flavors, but instead of organizing it geographically, you've organized it by season, fall, winter, spring, and Shabbat, which I love because it really spotlights the holiday cooking that's the backbone of Jewish food. Can you give me an example from your own background of a dish that's tied to both a season and a holiday equally?
Absolutely. So, and again, before I even share a dish, we're talking about produce. And I grew up in a kibbutz in Israel, and the kibbutz was covered, still covered, with pomegranate trees and fig trees and citruses. So when people in the States ask about when, let's say, pomegranates are in season, most time, I mean, depends on where you are, but people will say September. For me, the answer would be Rosh Hashanah. Same for, let's say, faba beans and artichokes, right? Like here in the States, you would say April or May. Again, depends where you live. For me, the answer is Passover. I love the soup course in the Passover chapter that's came from Chef Rinat Sadok. It's a Yemenite soup, but instead of the traditional bone broth, she uses hawayach, this spice blend, but it's a vegetarian dish and it's full with fresh artichokes and faba beans and Swiss chard. And I just find it to be so seasonal and delicious.
There's another one of her recipes for haroset balls, and there's so many ways to make haroset, the paste that symbolizes the mortar during the holiday of Passover. But I've rarely seen them done this way. Can you talk a little bit about her recipe and what's in them? They kind of resemble paleo energy ball snacks.
Exactly. So, this is our mom's recipe. but she adapted the recipe, and her version really draws inspiration from both of her grandparents, from both of her sides, from the Moroccan side and from the Yemenite. So she uses cardamom and sesame seeds, and that comes from her Yemenite side. And then she includes dates and hazelnuts from the Moroccan side. And she shaped them into this beautiful truffle size shape. So yes, I agree with you. Like, they're really beautiful on the Seder plates, but I would make them all year long.
Throughout the book, you are, you're the editor. You're sharing stories of various people who come from different places in the diaspora. Could you pick one for us that really shares the blending of a couple different cultures, and that happened because people have been in a place in diaspora for so long?
Absolutely. So I'm thinking about the table from Chef Fanny Gershon, who is based in New York City. She's a pastry chef who was born in Mexico City, but her grandparents immigrated from Ukraine. And I love her menu because it really encapsulates her family journey. So I'm thinking about her matzo ball soup course. So, you know, it has these deep flavors of traditional chicken soup, traditional Ashkenazi chicken soup. But on top of that, she uses fresh lime and cilantro and jalapenos. And she served the soup with avocado. And I just find, you know, it's just so beautiful and delicious. And she has another dish in her table for gefilte fish that she learned from her grandmother. And the gefilte fish is seared and then cooked in this aromatic sauce of tomatoes and peppers. And I think it just, again, like, kind of blend the family journey and bring it to the table in a very, you know, vivid way.
So let's talk about Jewish Food Society, this organization that you founded. Tell us a little bit about it and what it does.
Sure. So at the heart of our project is an online archive of family recipes and the histories that attach to them. Currently, we have more than 1,000 recipes and stories. And we equally care about the deliciousness of the recipe and the story behind it. So that's kind of the criteria of, you know, the recipes that we feature. And when we can, we join people in their home kitchens and we spend the day with them and we observe how they cook. We observe the person. We then bring back all of the learning and the knowledge and our notes to the test kitchen, and we develop the recipe and, you know, and make it as best as we can, so our readers and community can then go to their home kitchens and recreate it in the best way. And we also find that the kitchen is just the most intimate setting of them all. So this is also crucial when we talk about oral history and when we want to present the most powerful essay. Because many times, if you just pick up the phone and speak with your friend's grandma, who is an amazing cook, oftentimes the person would be very shy and won't really open up to you. But if you spend a few hours together in the kitchen, this is a completely different relationship. And oftentimes the person would bring some interesting artifacts and photos, and way, you know, deeper information will reveal itself.
I love that.
So that's, yeah, that's the core of what we do.
Well, thank you so much, Nama. It really is a beautiful book. There are so many recipes in here that I know I'm going to try. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.
That was Nahma Sheffy, founder of the Jewish Food Society and author of The Jewish Holiday Table. For a recipe for marak tamani, the Yemenite Passover soup made with fava beans and Swiss chard, visit our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. They say you can find anything on the internet. But when Carla Tatiana Vasquez went looking for Salvadoran recipes, she couldn't find many that satisfied her, nor a cookbook in English. So the writer, recipe developer, and food justice advocate decided to seek out and document them. She founded SalviSol, initially as a way to preserve her family's recipes. Since then, it has grown into so much more, expanding to document cultural memory and intergenerational connections among the Salvadorian diaspora. As part of that, she has just released the fantastic SalviSol cookbook. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Evan. So happy to be here.
Can you share with us the context in which your family found itself in Los Angeles?
Yeah, my family, like so many other families in the 80s, they had a lot of decision-making to make and weighing choices of whether it was safer to stay during the Civil War or whether it would be safer to go on a dangerous trek across many countries to safety. So my family left El Salvador in the late 80s, and we arrived here in the late 80s. It took about a month for them to leave El Salvador and then find themselves in Los Angeles.
What was the impetus that spurred you to write this book?
Oh man, there were so many. I think a big one has got to be about my grandmother. Growing up, I always felt like there was always this anxiety realizing that my grandmother, you know, wouldn't be here forever. And I think a lot of immigrant kids feel that way about their grandparents. There's a very special bond. And I think it's the yearning for understanding homeland and roots. And somewhere in 2015, I had this craving for salpicón. And salpicón is a wonderful meat dish. It's a dish with beef served with frijoles licuados, rice, a nice green salad on the side. And I really wanted to make it and I didn't know how. So I reached out to my mama, Lucy, and I said, you know, Ma Lucy, me ayuda, can you help me? And she said, claro que sí, Carla, yo te ayudo. And in that first cooking session that we had, I got to hear her story. You know, I'd always heard her story from my mom's point of view, other family members, where they kind of, you know, had this tone of like, wow, look at all she suffered. Look at all the things that she persevered. And it was an outsider's point of view. And listening to her share her own story, she was empowered. She was the heroine of the story. She was sharing, you know, with me that this were the choices, the options for a woman in the 60s in El Salvador. And she made the best ones that, you know, that were available to her. And you know, I quickly realized like, this is so much more. I'm craving more of these stories. I want to know more. And I shared with her, I said, you know, Ma Lucy, you know, I have this idea for a project. Maybe I record some more of your stories like we have been doing so with a few recipes. And she quickly was like, Carla, claro que sí. And I said, yes. And she said, yeah. De esto se trata del legado de la mujer salvadoreña, which translates to this is work about the legacy of Salvadoran women. So my grandmother is definitely where all of this started.
Okay, so now to the food. What are the primary colors, flavor-wise, of this Salvadoran kitchen?
The Salvadoran food palette is definitely one that loves salty, funky, tart, acid, fire-grilled foods. Lots and lots of, even there's a huge appreciation for bitter flavors. And I know in most cuisines or even in just like modern cooking here, you know, we try to add more fat to disguise the bitter flavor. But I have actually learned a lot about how much we love bitter flavors. One of the things that's very popular to eat in El Salvador are blossoms. And, you know, we eat our national flower. There's la flor de pacaya. Obviously, a lot of folks know about la flor de loroco, which is in pupusas. And something that for me growing up as a kid was, I want to be in the flower eating club, but I can't get past this bitter notes that are just so present. But they're there and they're celebrated. It's not something that you are disguising with fat or sweetness or salt or acid. You're really just wanting to appreciate it because that's la esencia. That's the essence of it.
The flor de azote particularly interests me because I have a huge stand of yucca trees in front of my house. And for decades, I've been aware of their use in much Central American cooking. And in fact, every year when they flower, people come along and ask my permission to harvest the flowers, which I just think is so wonderful. So tell me the classic dish that they're used for.
The classic dish that they're used for is huevos con flor de isote and with some tomatoes. So it's a breakfast dish, or sometimes it's actually served for dinner. And so, you know, after you have your flores de isote and you've cleaned them up, you do a little sofrito of tomato, onion. Maybe you throw in a little jalapeno, some bell pepper, and then you go ahead and add your flowers after that has softened, and you finish with some soft scrambled eggs that you mix it all, and now you have a wonderful scramble. I should also say that there are several different kinds of varieties. Similar to how we have different varieties of oranges or tomatoes, there's different yucca flowers, and the variety that grows in El Salvador is a little different than the variety that grows here in LA, but it still remains true that they are very similar.
What kind of beans are used in Salvadoran cuisine, and how does one pot of them reveal different uses as the week progresses?
Yes. So we love frijoles de seda, also known as Salvadoran frijoles, Salvadoran beans. Seda means silk, so it's a red silk bean. I've made the mistake of when I was early in my cooking journey of just thinking, oh, it's just a red bean. It's just a red frijol, any will do. And that is definitely not the case. The frijol de seda is super delicious. I love it. It gives you such a creamy and silky texture once you've pureed it. And, you know, having an olla de frijoles can definitely take you many places. You know, you start off on Sunday with your pot of frijoles. You may make that into a soup that has mamazos, which are little corn dumplings of sorts, into your soup. If you have some left over, you may choose to make casamiento, or you may choose to blend them, and then you can have them with plátanos fritos, or you can choose to refry them for pupusas. So it's one of the things I love. It's so fun. It is, if you haven't been raised in a Salvadoran or, you know, Latine household, it may seem strange to have a pot of beans. You leave it out, you don't put it in the fridge or anything like that, because it's just, it's there. It's easy. You boil it in the morning. You boil it right before you go to sleep. You boil it, you know, every time you take from it. But yeah, it's food in the house all the time.
Tell us about relajo. What is it and how is it used?
Relajo is the name of the spice blend that's used for our tamales. In the tamales, there's a sauce, and the sauce is called recaudo. And the recaudo is made with relajo. Relajo has pumpkin seeds, it has chilies, sesame seeds. Different people will add peanuts, they'll add all kinds of spices, bay leaves. Everyone kind of has their own interpretation. And I think learning about relajo actually also calmed some of my anxieties about becoming a person who's dedicated to cooking Salvadoran food. You know, I've seen these women who I've learned so much from and just kind of felt like, you know what, whatever they say is law and you can't, you know, steer too far away from it. And then you ask them about their relajo recipes and they'll say, well, I would never put this in it, or I'd never make the mistake of using that kind, or this blend, or the percentage of this seed must be higher than that. And you find everyone has a little bit of a difference, but essentially it's spices and seeds and chilies that are toasted and then blended in a sauce with tomatoes, onions, bell peppers, garlic, and that's what's used in the recaudo. It's an endearing term too, because relajo also means chaos. And so it's, you know, a cute, endearing thing to say. Salvadorans love relajo.
Well, thank you so much, Carla.
Yes, thank you so much, Evan. This is a dream to be here.
That was Carla Vasquez. Her new book is The Salvi Soul Cookbook, Salvadoran Recipes and the Women Who Preserve Them. You'll find a delicious recipe for flor de isote con huevos when you visit our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. And Angelinos, keep your eyes open for flowering yucca trees. I know the one in my front yard will be blooming very soon. In a minute, we've got stories of cooking and eating in southern Thailand when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Austin Bush has spent the better part of his life living in Thailand. Back in 2019, nearly 10 million people visited Phuket, the island in the southern part of the country, long promoted by tourism authorities, without setting foot in any other part of Thailand. That being said, there's not a cookbook in English dedicated to the cuisine of the South until now. 6 years after Austin focused on the food of the northern part of Thailand, he turns his sights further south. Hi, Austin. It's so good to have you back on the show.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me back.
First off, remind us how you ended up living in Thailand and what kept you in the country for over 20 years.
Well, originally it was language, actually. I was a student, a linguistic student at the University of Oregon, and I received a scholarship to study Thai at Chiang Mai University. And after that was done, I was there. I spoke a bit of Thai and just stayed on, which became 23 years.
So let's talk about the southern part of Thailand. Culturally and geographically, what part of the country is considered the south, and how is the landscape characterized across the region?
Yeah, so southern Thailand kind of culturally and geographically begins in this town called Chumphon, which is, I guess, I don't know how long it would take to drive from Bangkok, probably a good 5 or 6 hours. And you go south from there and Thailand becomes very narrow and it becomes very mountainous. And of course, there's a coastline on either side. People speak a different dialect. And as you go deeper south, the food changes. Like it's very, if you're familiar with Thai food, it's a very distinct, palpable sort of change.
So what distinguishes the dishes from their northern counterparts?
It's very different than northern Thai food, which I wrote about before. I mean, fundamentally really different. Like in northern Thailand, they eat sticky rice, you know, these different grains of rice that you eat by hand. And there's a lot of grilled dishes and raw meat dishes and things like that. And in southern Thailand, they eat long grain rice and the dishes are spicy. There's a lot of coconut milk and of course seafood and things like that. Southern Thai is the spiciest regional Thai cuisine. It's really, really spicy. Not every dish, but certain dishes are kind of insanely spicy. In that, I think, you know, the basis of a lot of Thai dishes are these pastes that are different herbs and spices pounded up together. And there's pastes in southern Thailand that use dry chilies, fresh chilies, black peppercorns and ginger all in the same paste, along with other things. So it's really, really spicy and intense. It can be, at least. And then beyond that, like, Southern Thai food kind of fits our sort of notion of Thai food as Americans, perhaps, because there's a lot of seafood, which I think a lot of people tend to associate with Thai food. There's a lot of coconut milk. It's spicy, as I mentioned, and it's also just really colorful and vibrant. You know, you get all these curries and these pastes that have, you know, really like beautiful orange colors from turmeric and deep red curry, and soups with turmeric as well that are yellow. So it's very vibrant. And then also, I think the influences in the South are very distinct as well. There's a lot of Chinese influence in Southern Thai food. There's Chinese influence across Thailand, but it takes a kind of almost like pure form in Southern Thailand, where there's Chinese dishes that really, I think, haven't been changed that much. And then there's also an influence from Malaysia, just which shares a border with Southern Thailand.
Can you talk a bit more about dishes that are a combination of indigenous and Chinese ingredients? Like, what dishes have resulted from that merging?
Probably the most interesting place for that kind of food is Phuket, the island that you mentioned in the beginning, that a place that a lot of people have been to. But I think actually a lot of people sort of are not aware of this cuisine or neglect it, because it's relegated to, I mean, nowadays not so many people make it, and it's kind of relegated to these inland cities rather than the places on the coast or on the beach. But in Phuket Town, as it's called in English, you'll find this entire repertoire of dishes that are, you know, essentially Chinese dishes, but that take advantage of Southeast Asian herbs and ingredients, lemongrass, coconut milk, all those sort of things. In Phuket, it's known as ba ba. You'll find a similar cuisine in parts of Malaysia as well, Peranakan or Nyonya, I think a lot of people have heard of. And one of the most famous examples is this dish in Phuket Town, that's called Mu Hong. And it's often takes the form of sort of fatty pork belly that's been braised with brown sugar and a lot of garlic, and then a kind of insane amount of cracked black pepper, and then soy sauce as well. I guess those are more sort of Chinese-leaning ingredients, but I don't know that it's a dish that necessarily exists in China. But it's amazing. It's really super rich and fatty and kind of unctuous, and you can smell it from a mile away. It's just very, very fragrant from all that pepper.
Sounds so good. So within the book, there are almost like these little vignettes as you travel to a particular place and kind of throw mm-hmm. yourself in to the meeting the people. And one person that you met was a man that you encountered who was picking coconuts with the help of monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about him and about the general area and the role of coconuts in this area?
So I was actually staying at his family home. That was a homestay, one of these places where you can stay in rural Thailand. And it was on this island that's called Gat Yao Noi, which is very close to Phuket. It's just like a 35-minute boat ride from Phuket, but very few people go there. I like this island a lot because it's a real island, meaning there's schools there and buffalo and rice fields, and people live and work there. It's not just for tourists. And one of the jobs there is picking coconuts. And this guy uses monkeys to pick coconuts. And I did an article about this guy previously, and that sort of made its way into the book. People will give him a call. He will go in a motorcycle that has a sidecar with two monkeys on it. He'll drive over to their house. And he has a really, really long leash. And he just lets them go. And they climb up, and he has some commands that he uses with the monkeys. They're trained. I think he bought the monkeys trained. They're quite expensive. And basically they run up and they sort of spin the coconuts around in their between their legs until they just fall off. And, you know, coconuts are quite big, so it's this really loud, kind of scary thud hitting the ground. And this guy shouting commands to a monkey. It's a very one of the strangest sort of days of work I've ever seen in my life.
And the monkeys differentiate the the unripe from the mature coconuts.
Yeah, I think they've been trained to look at the color of the coconuts, if I remember correctly. And he gives them a treat at the end. It was fascinating. And, you know, I posted something about that on Instagram, and quite a few people got upset about it. And, you know, people were concerned about animal cruelty and things like that. And I can't speak for using monkeys in that way in a general sense. But what I saw with this guy, he seemed to treat the monkeys quite well. They seemed to enjoy what they were doing. I didn't get any idea or sense of cruelty or anything like that. And yeah, it was just a fascinating thing that I never would have expected that I could see.
And because there are so many coconut palms and there are so many coconuts, there is an enormous food culture that uses the flesh and the milk that comes from these fruits. Can you talk a little bit about, in that area, what the coconuts are mostly used for?
Coconut milk is not the water that's the sort of clear liquid inside of a coconut, but rather people shred the white flesh or meat of relatively mature coconuts, and then that's squeezed out, kind of pressed to create the milk. And I spent a day cooking with this woman that has a stall there. And the coconuts there are so amazing and so sort of fatty. She literally just took some grated coconut, dipped it in water, and then squeezed it in her hand over a sieve. And all this fatty, you know, coconut milk came out. It was amazing. And she was making something called khnum jin. And khnum jin is the name of a noodle, but it's often served with all these different kind of like curry dishes. And she was making the kind of stereotypical Southern Thai khnum jin, nam ya pak thai, it's called. And it's shredded fish. It's got turmeric, just like almost every other Southern Thai dish. Chili, of course, black pepper. It's served over these thin, freshly extruded Thai rice noodles. And then the amazing part about it is it's served with this like virtual buffet of optional sides. So you get pickled vegetables, you get vegetables that are sort of simmered in coconut milk, you get all these herbs and like cashew leaves that taste kind of astringent, or other leaves that are bitter, other that taste like licorice or things like that. And you kind of, it's your job as an eater to shred and choose these things and put them in your on top of your noodles. And then another really common dish or type of dish to make out of coconut milk there are sweets. There's just tons and tons of different kinds of sweets, often revolving around sticky rice, sweetened with coconut milk, the kind of things that are wrapped in banana leaves and boiled or steamed or grilled. And yeah, it's just this amazing resource that people have literally in their backyard and take advantage of every day.
Yeah, we're so lucky here in Los Angeles. We have Thai sweet shops that are filled with these kinds of desserts.
I've heard about that.
Well, thank you so much, Austin. As always, it's wonderful to talk to you. And the book is just it's such a deep dive into so many different communities. And you can really get the flavor of it with your photographs. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. Thanks for having me.
That was Austin Bush. He follows up his James Beard nominated The Food of Northern Thailand with The Food of Southern Thailand. If you're looking for a natural starting point to start cooking Southern Thai food, we've got a recipe for you on our website. Just head to kcrw.com/goodfood. LA Times restaurant critic Bill Addison made his way to Los Angeles via the South. So when a soulful Southern restaurant opened in downtown, we suspected we may be hearing more from him. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan.
So who's in the kitchen at Joyce, and what is the chef's background? What other projects has he been associated with in LA?
Yeah, so the chef is Sammy Mansour, who grew up in North Carolina. His ancestry is Lebanese, and so his parents ran a restaurant that I believe was Lebanese in North Carolina. And he was the chef at Prue and Proper recently in downtown Los Angeles as well, that closed during the pandemic. So I'm happy that he's back with his perspective on global Southern cooking downtown.
So with a raw bar and also some regional favorites, given your Southern food bent, how do you navigate the menu? What are some of your favorites?
Yeah, I would say, I should not contradict myself too much and say that, you know, he does have kind of a global thinking about Southern food. But, you know, as someone with my own Southern roots, I own that I prefer the already complex dishes of that region kind of in a more straightforward way. So I'm thinking about his very crusty and cheddar-y baked mac and cheese. He has a honey-glazed fried game hen with a side of angel biscuits that are really good. They're tiny, but they tower in the right way. And a very good smoked pork chop over grits with a coffee-spiked jus that's a play on red-eye gravy that's very beloved in the South. And chow chow, which is the South's ubiquitous pickled relish. And there are some very good beignets for dessert.
And then there's the rice dish.
I should mention that. Thank you, Evan. It's purlieu, which is a highly seasoned staple of the South Carolina Lowcountry traditions. It's usually fortified with a very rich stock. It often has pork as the main kind of flavor booster. It could be bacon grease, salt pork, and often seafood. Sammy's version has oysters and shrimp and chorizo, so he gets that kind of porky flavor in there. And it's nice because it's a little soupy, but in a really good way, in a way that actually reminds me of bog, another South Carolinian rice dish. And thank you, Evan. That is the number one thing that I recommend ordering for dinner at this restaurant.
You know, oftentimes these days, it seems like there's quite a big difference between a lunch menu and a weekend brunch menu, for example, at restaurants from their dinner offerings. Does Joyce have this gap, this difference?
Yes, and I would say too, just as an aside, that lunch in Los Angeles restaurants, I feel like, is more rare than it used to be. It's like either you specialize in lunch or you specialize in dinner. But yes, Joyce, being downtown, very centrally located, has some fun, more casual riffs during the day. So there's a messy, really good spicy chicken sandwich paved with pimento cheese at lunch. And then brunch, which I think has found some momentum, has some fun things like there's a smash burger that's kind of slicked with Duke's mayo, which is very Southern, sweetened even more with maple syrup and cinnamon and avocado toast and things like that. But me being the Southerner, I will say that I go straight for the collards, which are legitimate and long simmered, and shrimp over grits, which tastes like home to me.
Oh, how nice. Well, thank you so much, Bill.
Yeah, thank you, Evan. Always great to talk with you.
That was LA Times restaurant critic Bill Addison talking about Joyce in downtown LA. To find a link to Bill's review, go to our website, kcow.com/goodfood. Did you know that California cuisine was invented in Santa Monica? It's true. When Michael McCarty opened his eponymous restaurant, Michael's, in 1979, he launched a revolution in dining. He looks back on 45 years of farm-to-table cuisine on the Market Report. That's next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Let's head to the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where Jillian Ferguson has a special guest on this week's Market Report.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I could not be more excited to be here at the Santa Monica Farmers Market today with Michael McCarty. Michael is the Michael behind Michael's Restaurant in Santa Monica, which celebrates 45 years this week. Hello, sir.
Hello. Great to be here.
Well, congratulations on 45 years. From where we're standing right now, we can practically see your restaurant. I think a golfer could hit a golf ball and actually land there.
A chip shot, you'd be right in. Hole in one.
Exactly. So you opened in 1979. You were 25 years old. The farmer's market wasn't even here yet. Kind of set the scene for us.
Well, you know, in those days, similar to everywhere in the United States, each major city had 6 or 8 restaurants. You know, now, of course, every major city has 30 in every neighborhood, which is great. I came here because my parents had moved to California, and I got here December of 75, and the weather was stunning, and I just said, you know, after the first half of the 70s in Paris, I said, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. And just started the thinking behind a restaurant. I'd already had a little place on Ile Saint-Louis, which was sort of this totally illegal bootlegged pop-up is what they would call it today. But it got me going, and Ile Saint-Louis in those days was still a little village. You had 3 fish guys, you had 3 meat guys, you had 3 poultry guys, 3 pork guys, the cheese, the this and the that. And they would all leave me what I needed after I got out of school, came back at night. They'd all be sitting on my doorstep. And whatever was there is what I cooked that night. And so that thinking was always very much part of the ethos of everything that I do. And when we got here, I looked around to see what was being grown here. And I looked for a place. And believe me, I could give you a whole list of the places I went to. And some are pretty gnarly. But I ended up with this one last. And this was a wasteland. The 3rd Street Promenade had tumbleweeds going down it. But we had a Woolworths. You could get a smash burger before smash burgers and a malted chocolate milkshake. And I just loved the fact that it was 10 miles from my house.
But when you opened in 1979, this, where we're standing, the farmer's market didn't exist. No, it didn't open until 1981. So
a couple of years later. But I had, through Jean, Bertrandoux and L'Hermitage, I got to know all the purveyors, Dennis Weiss, Northern Produce. He introduced me to Oxnard Plain, the Ventura. He did the Inland Empire. And so through him, I learned what was growing here and what wasn't growing here. Remember something, in those days, basically, if you wanted fresh herbs, you didn't get them. You went to the supermarket and they were in the spice rack. The same thing with fish. You ordered fish wholesale, it was basically frozen. One of the things we did is we decided to build ourselves a duck farm because we didn't have any good duck. We built a farm in Acton with a Muscovy male and a Pekin female. We created the hybrid called the Mullard, and which you use for confit and the what do you call it, the magret, and make foie gras. We made some of the first foie gras in America there. But anyway, so it was this sort of learning where I'm swimming. Mm-hmm. And then we just began, I mean, I've bought from these people for 42 years.
Yeah. You know, I went back and read the Ruth Reichel New West magazine from 1979, I believe, when you opened. And the menu reads more French, but it doesn't seem out of place with what you would cook today.
No, exactly not. In other words, remember, I was schooled in France. So we started out with what we knew. And then the more we got involved, and we more felt this and lived in the sun, the more we developed the recipes. And I remember the day we took French off the menu. We always had French with English translations, but then there was a day, I think it was like a year later or less, where we said, that, we're going with English only, and we're going to name the farmers. And people start to make fun of us. It was like San Fernando Valley Greens with Gus Lardones. We'd associate all the growers with whatever was in each dish. People kept saying, San Fernando Valley Greens? I said, yeah, there's a guy out there growing this stuff. I think he's still there. You know, it just over 45 years, it's just morphed. I mean, how many farmers markets have we got in L.A. now?
So this idea of farm-to-table food,
right?
Did it feel revolutionary in the moment, or is it only with hindsight that it feels that way?
Well, it's very interesting because I know people use the term farm-to-table, but as I said, when I opened, there were no farms to create the farm-to-table. So part of our job was that, and it seemed like a natural evolution where your mind is like a puzzle, and it all goes around, and it comes together and goes click. And then you move on to the next issue, whether it's the jazz music or the Ralph Lauren clothes or the garden or the dinners or the wine dinners. I mean, wine was another thing that was exploding in those days. We were called California Cuisine, which was pretty obvious because what we were really doing was regional American food. We just happened to be doing it first here. Alice and Jeremiah Tower and Mark Miller in Northern California were doing the same thing, basically. They were transitioning from French food to their definition of what new American food was, incorporating all these local farmers around them. They were as blessed with areas up there as we are down here. I guess so the answer is, I think everyone thought it was revolutionary and it was exciting and there was no blood in the streets, so it was good.
Yeah, it still feels exciting.
Yeah. Oh my God, the new generations of chefs coming on. I mean, that's the beauty of it. I sat there today, as I said, people watching it, and I watched generation after generation of young chefs, men, women, everybody, all sizes and shapes, coming by with their trolleys brimming with product. And that means we're winning. That means the revolution has been televised and has succeeded.
All right, Michael. Well, congratulations on 45 years. It's quite a milestone.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That was Michael McCarty of Michael's in Santa Monica. The restaurant celebrates 45 years this weekend. This Sunday, the restaurant welcomes back many of their alumni for a special anniversary tasting. Tickets are available on Resy, and all proceeds benefit No Kid Hungry.
No Kid Hungry.
For The Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks, as always, to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Elena Shatkin, and to our engineers, Hope Brush and Sue Margulies. And a special thanks to Laura Kondarajan and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. Don't forget to RSVP for next weekend's Pie Fest and contest. The details are at kcrw.com/pie. I'll see you at UCLA on the 28th, and of course, I will meet you back here next week for another episode of Good Food.